all marked by statewide.
Right, thanks, Ted. Well, first, my apologies go to the cosmologists in the audience, the pure kind of cosmologists, because this talk is mostly going to be sort of string theory phenomenology. But I would like to point out that these kind of problems are all very much related. So, you know, the ultimate idea is to find a string theory scenario which does reproduce the correct cosmology and phenomenology. And this has to come about through through a correct kind of procedure of modulized stabilization, as I'll try to.
Our cosmologists aren't sure they're dirty. Yeah,
okay, so so this work is based on some papers with Fernando and Ben Balnack, who's a postdoc at Cambridge, and previous work with Joe Connell and Fernando again. So let me just give you our final talk first. So first up, I'm going to review the usual story of why we care about soft supersymmetry breaking and how that ties up with the moduli fixing string theory. And I'm going to review the recent spectacular progress in the moduli fixing story, which is basically the papers of GKP and KPLT. And later on, I will point out this other class of complications of type 2B string theory, which are kind of comparable to the KKLT complications, which have this peculiar property of having exponentially large volumes for the Calabria manifold. And I will try to elucidate this story of moduli, how moduli fixing concretely works in terms of what resulting masses for the moduli are going to be, roughly speaking, and how one can try to obtain the soft terms in these sort of complications as well for the visible matter. And I'm going to try to list some scenarios which some cosmologically interesting scenarios which come out of these large volume computations. And I will analyze them using a renormalization group equation analysis and impose phenomenological constraints on them and see how far we can get with this kind of thing. So what sort of thing string theory, it is in this particular class of computations, can give us for in terms of, say, LHC phenomenology. And then I will conclude. Okay, so let's start off by recalling one of the primary motivations for believing in low-energy supersymmetry is because it provides a solution to the hierarchy problem. Now, of course, supersymmetry is not an exact explanation; it must be broken, and supersymmetry breaking must be parameterized by a certain set of terms, which are the Lagrangian for the visible matter, which are called the soft terms. And they're soft. They're called soft because they do not reproduce quadratic divergences, which is precisely what you want to avoid, what low-energy supersymmetry avoids, the quadratic divergences which makes the Higgs mass large. Okay, and of course, the fermion masses are forbidden by Gauge. So what do we see in this Lagrangian? Well, they're soft masses for the scalar fields, the trilinear fields, trilinear couplings between the scalars. There's a B term, which is only possible by which is only allowed by Gauge numerics for the Higgs field, and there are also the Gino masses.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. This is pointing. Looks like a hook. right. So fermion masses are not there because they're forbidden by Gauge numerics, just like inside one. Right. So the question we want to ask ourselves is what is possible to say anything about these soft terms from a string theory point of view, or well, supergravity, because we're going to be working first with the low energy limit of string theory. Right. So the setup, the general setup is going to be that of n equals one supergravity in four dimensions, and we're going to split all the four dimensional fields into two kind of classes. They're going to be bulk moduli and also matter living on rings, which are also going to be moduli from a low-energy point of view. So they'll look like light fields. And the general story of how one tries to describe supersymmetry breaking is that it must be broken in a hidden sector of the theory, which means by the bulk moduli. And this is mediated by sort of gravitational strength interactions to the visible sector, to the visible fields. Now, the strategy in doing this until recently has been that you just assume that supersymmetry is broken by some kind of moduli fields. and you assume that they're fixed. There was no mechanism for actually fixing the module. And you also have to assume that the cosmological quantum is somehow set up to be approximately equal to zero. And there have been no microscopic mechanisms for actually doing these kind of things. But recently, the progress in flux modifications has essentially given answers and mechanisms, control mechanisms to do all of these aforementioned things. So this is based on the papers of Giddings, Kashu, Polchinski, and Kashu, Kalos, Linden, and Trivedi. So GKP and KKLT, in brief. Okay, so the idea of the, firstly the GKP paper is that they noticed that the flux complications allow you to fix all the complex special moduli and the dilaton. And this can be easily seen from low energy point of view through the appearance of this group of upper weights and superpotential, which is an integral of this 3-point G3 and the almost 3-point on the Calabi-Yau manifold. And the G3, of course, depends on the RR and NS fluxes on the Calabi-Yau manifold, and also the dilaton. And obviously, this superpotential depends on the dilaton because that enters G3. And it also depends on the complex special moduli through this integral and through the appearance of omega itself in the integral. So the idea is that in the GKP process kind of thing, you can integrate this superpotential will give a masses to the module. And then these moduli can be integrated out, giving you a non-zero superpotential, which indicates that the supersymmetry is broken. And the next step now is to fix all the remaining moduli in the complication, which is the Kähler moduli. Now, these moduli have to be fixed by non-perturbative effects because they do not appear in this group of algorithm perturbative superpotential. So one needs an extra set of effects which come about through either Euclidean D3 instantons or Gaussian condensation on D7 rings. And those will give you this kind of non-perturbative superpotential in the Kähler moduli, which is indicated here. And then this allows you to fix the Kähler moduli in a supersymmetric anti-de-Sitter minimum. So what the scalar potential roughly looks like in terms of the Kähler moduli is this here on the top. And you can see the appearance of the supersymmetric anti-de-Sitter minimum. Now the last step of the KKLT process is to lift the cosmological constant to a small positive value, and this can be done. This is sort of the least well understood part of the whole process, and it can be done in various ways, but none of them are completely satisfactory. So you can either insert these anti-D3 veins at bottom of word throats, which explicitly breaks supersymmetry, or you can think about introducing D terms supersymmetry breaking in the theory, but that also doesn't quite seem to work perfectly because there's all this story about the D term having to vanish if the F terms vanish at the same time. But leaving that aside for the time being, we think we can do this sort of thing. So we can lift the cosmological constant. So now we do have supersymmetry breaking. We have a small positive cosmological constant. And the question is whether one can say something about the soft breaking terms in this sort of setup. Well, in the KKLT scenario itself, this turns out to be fairly difficult because firstly, there's the issue of checking stability of the vacuum you get through this kind of thing, through this process, and the stability has to be checked on an example by example basis, and this is very 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 hard because you have to know the Kähler potential for the complex special moduli, so you have to really understand your Calabi-Yau manifold fairly well, and this is not, you know, not a lot is known generically about these sort of Calabi-Yaus. Usually you just have to find second derivatives of the scalar potential, which is a function of hundreds and hundreds of moduli, and you have to diagonalize that and check that the mass matrix is positive definite, mass square matrix is positive definite, which is a very difficult problem indeed. So that's just one part of the story. Secondly, let us remember that supersymmetry breaking, of course, is expressed through the non-vanishing of the F terms for the bulk moduli. Now, these F terms were zero at this minimum up there, because it was a supersymmetric minimum. So the entire supersymmetric breaking came out of this lifting process. So everything was zero beforehand, it was supersymmetric, and then we lift using a D term, and then one deduces small F terms into the game. And then it's very difficult to see to compute these epitopes explicitly, because it's also very, very model dependent in a sense. And everything is of the same order of magnitude. The epitopes and the V-terms seem to be of the same order of magnitude. It's really hard to tell in kind of model independent, fairly model independent way, what the sizes of supersymmetry breaking terms are going to be. And the last problem with this, with the KKLT setup in terms of computing soft terms, is that the Calabi-Yau volume V turns out to be proportional to the logarithm of W0, which is the flux-induced superpotential. This the value of G wedge, integral G wedge omega over the Calabi-Yau. Now, to trust supergravity, the volume has to be very large so that you can neglect all the string operations. Of course, to achieve V large on this formula, you can see that W0 has to be very, 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 very small indeed. And that's also necessary for small scale of supersymmetry breaking. So small gravity mass, incidentally. And it's very, very difficult indeed to achieve these small values of W0 in particular examples, because you have to look through a whole lot of flux like here to find value of W0, which is so small. I believe Professor Davis will tell you more about the computational difficulty of this sort of problem tomorrow or today.
Doesn't small W not also have this problem that means that all the complex structure moduli are getting lighter? And that then it's
no, the complex structure moduli masses do not depend on W0. Because W0 is a measure of supersymmetry breaking. Complex structure moduli get masses even if you don't break supersymmetry. So W0 is only proportional to a certain component of flux. It's proportional to 0.3 flux. But any sort of flux will fix complex structure moduli.
I thought that the W naught was expressing the potential for these other complex structure models.
Yeah, it is.
So the potential is giving them a mass. So somehow W naught is encoding the physics says that their mass is proportional. If you're making W naught small, it sounds like you should be making all the masses of these guys small too.
No, you're making the amount of supersymmetry breaking small, but not the masses of one flux. So supersymmetric fluxes will also give masses to complex structure moduli.
You're not rescaling the home potential, you're keeping the second derivatives more or less fixed while just getting from the minimum to zero.
Because the masses are typically the second derivatives of the scalar potential. So
okay, I'll ask you about it again later then. I'll ask you about it after
Okay, so the question arises whether we have any sort of alternative to the KKLT class of computations where we could have more control over the computation of soft terms. It turns out there is an alternative, and these are these computations which are in essence very similar to KKLT, but they use perturbative correction to the scalar potential, as well as these non-perturbative corrections to the superpotential, which are necessary to stabilize the scalar moduli. And these were developed by Vijay, Professor Bramley, Per Berman, and later on Michael Lovertis, Joe, and Fernand. And the nice thing about these complications is that one finds automatically tachyon-free, so stable, large volume minima. Now, by large volume here, I mean that at the minimum of the potential, the volume is exponentially dependent on certain factors. So it's very easy to obtain very, very large volumes, but very, very large values for it. And in these complications also, there's no need whatsoever to fine-tune the value of W0. So it works for W0 or for the one, which is the generic thing one expects. So you don't need to start off by finding a kind of ridiculously fine-tuned flux function. You can just take any flux function you want and work with that.
So how reliable is this conclusion that the volume is stabilized at the large values if you include only leading alpha prime corrections? What if I go next over that? Is that somehow the leading order computation we have an argument that it's...
Yeah. Because the point is it's kind of self-consistent thing. So you find that the alpha prime, if I remember this correctly, the alpha prime expansion is essentially also an expansion in one over the volume. So if I find a minimum, just including the first set of alpha prime corrections, which has a large volume, then all the others will be very, very much suppressed with respect to these sort of corrections.
That's not obvious to me. It looks like the you're assuming a large volume, so all alpha-prime corrections are suppressed, and then you're saying, I'm going to look at the first one, and then you're going to make a physical conclusion that it provides a stabilization. So how do I know that the other will not?
I think that you can prove that this is a sort of self-consistent thing. There's also the worry of which alpha-prime corrections to include, because the one which is included here is only one of them. It's the one which is known in the M theory, from the M theory point of view, is the R34 kind of correction. But of course, there could be other terms also entering at the same order with alpha prime. But if you check the volume, again, you can check the volume dependence of all these other terms, and they turn out to be subleading with respect to this.
I guess my question is, if I turn off the alpha prime corrections, where is the volume?
What happens? Well, then you're just back in KKLT. Then you will need an extremely small W0 to find.
So the point is that
KKLP is, in a sense, only consistent if you take a very, very, very small W0, whereas these things are also, you know, they're two minima of potential, essentially. These things are also there where W0 is over 1, as you kind of expect.
So KKLP is W0 small because you're somehow balancing the W0 against the expansion.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Because yeah, exactly. So.
But in your case, you're balancing the exponential against the alpha prime correction,
right?
Yes. So the claim is that it's enough to balance with the first.
In a sense, KKLP is slightly unnatural because you're kind of saying, okay, let's assume that the perturbative contribution to the superpotential is the same order as the non-perturbative one. And then you're completely justified in neglecting the perturbative corrections to the KKLP potential. But here you say, well, suppose that as you expected, the non-perturbative contribution to the superpotential is much smaller than the perturbative contribution to the potential, but then you have to take into account the perturbative correction to the KKLP potential as well.
So superpotential doesn't have any perturbative
corrections? No, I'm sorry, not correction, just the true level value of the superpotential. I'm sorry, yeah. It's of the same order. Okay. But okay, so the one specific thing about this minimum is that it turns out that the moduli are stabilized in non-supersymmetric and supersymmetric. So we already have supersymmetry breaking to start off, which is essentially different from the KKLT scenario. And in a sense, that does facilitate the computation of all the supersymmetry breaking parameters quite a lot. And the working example we used to study this is this hypersurface in this particular weighted projective space, 11169, which has two Keller moduli and a whole bunch of complicated moduli. But again, we don't have to check stability explicitly because it just turns out that that you have automatic stability of these minima. It's easy to see from the form of the potential and where the minimum is. And the idea is that so the large parameter which we can use to express our results for the orders of magnitude of all the soft breaking mass and soft parameters is this volume of the Calabi-R. So we're going to be dropping all the kind of order one factors because the volume is expected to be exponentially large. It's very, very large. So one of those volume is a small parameter, just like W0 was a small parameter in a sense in KKLT. And we can compute the masses using standard techniques in supergravity. So you start off with this big Keller potential on top, which has these kind of standard factors. So the first part is the Keller potential for the Keller moduli with the alpha prime correction coming in, and the second part is S plus S star, the Keller potential for a dilaton, and you have the Keller potential for a complex structure. And we're going to use the superpotential, which has two non-perturbative contributions to it, depending on the two Keller moduli. Recall that this particular model had two Keller moduli. But the story actually works in the general case. You can prove that this minimum exists for an arbitrary model which has more complex structure moduli than Keller structure moduli. So in a sense, half of all Calabi-Yau's because they come in mirror pairs. So for any manifold, I can find a mirror manifold which has this property disk.
In this model, you have a lot of Keller moduli. Right?
Two, just two. What's the complex structure?
I meant complex structure,
yes.
H21. So you can verify explicitly that you can stabilize all of
the minimum. The minimum is generically
So you're saying to KPI, I have enough cycles, classes?
Oh, yes, yes. So in terms of cycles, yeah, you're fine. I mean, there are lots of cycles. The stability is the kind of difficult thing. But again, it ties, so the question of stability here ties in with this, with the fact that it's not, it's a subsymmetry breaking minimum. So in a sense, if you don't have, if you have a non-subsymmetry breaking minimum, then you must have W very, very small to ensure stability, which is kind of going back to the KKLT. So if W is equal to zero in the KKLT case, then you have automatic stability. And you can actually ensure, you can actually look at these kind of minima as well. So Minkowski minima with W equals to zero. So this was done recently by Linda and others.
But it's just to continue off the question, I mean, in just in broad terms, it sounds like what you have is a series, the off-parameter expansion, you've got some small parameter epsilon, and you've got a power series epsilon, and then there's some exponentially small terms that are after that, which are what the supervention is counting for you. And if you had not had the non-trivial things, if you tried to balance, get a minimum of the potential of the function of epsilon by balancing different powers of epsilon, then we would have been suspicious of the epsilon expansion, right? But it sounds like what you're doing is you're saying that there's a term in a power in epsilon, which is coming from the scalar function, and that's being balanced against a term which is exponentially small in epsilon coming from the supervention. And somehow it seems like that means that I know that this is...
I'm not sure, what do you mean by this? It's being balanced?
Well,
I mean, it's a kind of, if something happens at large, one is dominating at large volume, the other one is dominating at small volume kind of thing. I mean, it's complicated.
Well, it's the same thing as controlling both of those. The volume is controlling the size of the exponent, and it's also controlling the size of the off-prime correction. And so it's like I'm balancing, I'm getting a shape potential which has a minimum, because the one part of the shape is coming from the exponential, one part is coming from the top of the power of the volume.
Right.
But if I've arranged for the expansion to be as big as one of the powers, it seems like why are all the other powers that were in there too come equally big, because the exponential was supposed to be smaller than all the powers. So it's like I've gone to a point in field space where I've made the exponential as important as the powers, and so then it seems like I have to know everything to know what the shape potential is.
I'm not sure I followed this.
Well, so I know that the inherent, I've asked Matt this, and he says that, well, if you look at the powers of one over R, mm-hmm. one over volume that come into various corrections, he says that they're smaller than what you've already got in your potential.
Yeah.
But it just seems that I don't really understand the mechanism why. Just in general terms, it seems like you've got a series, and you've got a variable that you're following as a series with exponential corrections, and you've got a minimum for that variable because you balance an exponential against an exponentially small term against the power term. And that just seems to me to be all the warning bells go off. There's something wrong with the whole approximation if I can do that.
But in a sense, you're not really balancing. The exponential against just the power like term, because I mean, firstly, you need more than two moduli for this thing to work. That's one more requirement, and it's kind of the limit you look at is kind of where one of the moduli is big and all the others are still order one. There's one in terms of geometry. There's one really big cycle, and this is the cycle which corresponds to the overall volume, and there are lots of kind of string size, string length, you know, four cycles, which are the other moduli which enter the game. But they have to, you know, you must have more than two for this kind of thing to work. So it's kind of, well, I think it's...
But you're not saying, so it's not like there's two of them that are, if you had two cycles that are both large, you might imagine there's two small parameters in the problem. And then maybe balancing, because there's two series somehow, it's alpha prime for one radius squared and alpha prime for another radius squared. And then you can imagine balancing the two against one another and getting a two radii both large, but similar size or something. But it sounds like that's not what's going on.
There's one big radius
and one large one. So then the whole series is being controlled by the largest radius somehow.
Yeah, which is the overall volume.
But then
you can stay like that.
The objection of the one parameter that's small, how do you balance the exponential in that one parameter with the power of that one parameter? Seems like that's the generic objection.
The point is, you look at a particular limit where, in a sense, I mean, if you look at what the scalar potential looks like in this particular limit, there's no exponential terms remaining. It just looks like everything looks like, you know, you have minus log v over v cubed or something like that, and that competes with something like 1 over v cubed or something like this. So this minus log v over v cubed thing dominates for large volume. So I don't think there's no, you know, exponential things as such. But this log v, again, it comes because of the fact that you have more than one matrix, you have two multiplying. One is this overall thing, which is the volume, and the other one looks like the log one on it. So it's kind of so much logarithmically smaller than that kind of thing. So.
So thanks. Maybe so you are saying that the alpha prime directions are small in order for me to get this large volume, right? So maybe that's the way out. So even though you need the alpha prime correction to balance to get an extremum, but you manage to do this while keeping alpha prime corrections very small.
Right. No, they're small.
So that term which you use to balance it is very small. So the next one is basically a square or roughly what you used before. And so maybe it's a little bit unusual. So usually when we do things like a new phenomena happens in this process, and usually all the terms get important. But that's important when all the terms are four than one. Mm-hmm. If you are saying you succeeded in doing it while keeping the terms small, then that's reasonable that all the other parts might be self-consistent perceptions.
Yeah. There's also the issue of GS corrections, so stringy loop corrections. But you also, I think Joe looked it up, because there's only, not much is known about the stringy loop corrections. But there was one paper by Boris Kors and his group, and but this is done in the toroidal, I think in toroidal bus. So we did try, Joe tried something, he tried taking that, the results for the string corrections and seeing what happens with these kind of things. It was still stable at that.
But that's complex structure modules. So the G string, so I can consistently stabilize at the value when G string is very small.
Yes,
fairly small. So I shouldn't worry that much.
Yeah.
Provided you can argue between the complex structure and the Taylor module, right? That's why I was wondering what the
But no, but that's not true with the masses. I mean,
well,
value of GS is not true. Okay, so I have to speed up. But so the idea is now we have all the ingredients. We have the Taylor potential, the superpotential of the theory, and you can compute the there's a general formula for the scalar potential in n equals one supergravity. From this we can deduce what the bulk punchline masses are, and you can just find how they scale with respect to the small expansion parameter, which is the one over the large volume that we have found. And essentially, you get all of these modules, the Gratina mass and the complex structure moduli scaling. The scaling is one over the volume. And there's one, the big, so the modulus corresponding to the big four cycle in the Calabi yaw, which is the kind of overall volume, is very light, which could have some cosmological implications. And you can check that the Kaluza quantum scale is bigger than all the chances. So the effect of supergravity point of view is valid here. And the next thing one should worry about is the brain moduli. So in these kind of models, you're going to get V3 and V7 brains. And we're going to investigate the geometric moduli for these D-brains, which basically correspond to some to geometric deformations, either the movement of the D3 brains or geometric deformations of the D7 brains themselves. Now, the funny thing about D3 brains is that without including any of these alpha prime and non-certainty effects, the masses for these geometric moduli turn out to be just zero. And this is true in the non-scale approximation. But in these kind of models, you have two sources of break of non-scale. Of the non-scale structure, which is the alpha prime and non-certainty effects. So, by including these, you guess that something is going to happen with these V3 brain moduli. I mean, there's an argument that V3 moduli are always stabilized because their moduli space is the Calabi yaw itself, which is a compact manifold. So they must sit somewhere. So the idea here is to find to first compute all the F terms. Which is done here.
Why is this contingent on time? What have I done at first? I mean, can I have a compact space where I have a flat record?
Well, it's a flat record, sure. But once you broke the supersymmetry, including all these effects, the effect is generically stateless. So once one computes the actors, it's actually very simple to get the soft breaking terms and masses and elements, because you have formulas such as this one here, which expresses the soft breaking term in terms of things like the gravitational mass and the F terms, and certain parameters like the Kalor potential for these D three brainwaves like themselves. And we know what those look like from papers by Yan Li and his group. And there's a similar formula for Gijinu masses. So Gijinu masses for D3 brains turn out to depend, because the gauge kinetic function for D3 brains is the dilaton, basically. The Gijinu masses depend on the F term corresponding to the dilaton. And the F term corresponding to the dilaton in these models, because it's a very small kind of deformation from the node scale, where the dilaton exponential value, where the dilaton F term just vanishes, are very small. They look like 1 over the volume squared. So the Gijinu masses are very, very small. And the scalar masses themselves turn out to be slightly suppressed with respect to the gravitational mass by this power of 1 v to the minus 1 over 6, which can be fairly large if the volume is big.
So we said that the string scale is 1 over v square root, the Hilbert-Kahn scale is 1 over v.
1 over Hilbert-Kahn scale is slightly bigger than 1 over v. By slightly bigger, it means a different power of V. So if you have a hierarchy, the string scale is bigger than that, which is bigger than 1 over V, which is the masses of the moduli, etc. And these masses are even slightly suppressed with respect to that. So the bulk moduli are heavier than these, in some sense. For these 7 brains, on the other hand, the situation is slightly different, because you can see from the F theory point of view that just like the complex structure moduli and the dilaton are stabilized. Because in F theory, the D7 brain moduli are part of the complex structure of the four pole in which you compactify. You expect them to get masses induced by fluxes in the same way as the complex structure moduli do. And indeed, you can confirm this from an explicit 4D supergravity point of view. And you get masses which are just proportional to M3 halves, which is the kind of amount of supersymmetry gradient, which is dependent on W0. So that's.
Okay, so the reason I'm asking is that for the target of the soft breaking terms, your assumption there is that the splitting in the supermodule that you're following is smaller than the cutoff that you've integrated out.
Yeah.
And so in this case, the cutoff I'm supposed to think of we've integrated out is the Hilbert-Kahn scale rather than the M3 half. So M3 half is down in the four dimensional theory.
Yeah.
So I don't remember what the power of the
Hilbert-Kahn
scale was.
I'm not sure if I had it written down, but
the main thing is that
what's the question?
All the answers you're going to get for these guys that are being split is small compared to the
So you can't trust supergravity. It's fine. There's also the possibility of getting Wilson line moduli for these 7 brains, but we neglect this because continuous Wilson line moduli means you must have one cycle within the 4 cycles that the D7 brains are wrapping, and this is generically not going to happen in Calabi element flows, because Calabi owls themselves don't have any one cycles. So these are not really present there. There's also an issue of, if you want to realize the standard model on D7 brains, then you can't wrap these D7 brains on the big 4 cycle, because the gauge kinetic function for the D7s is exactly the Kalor modulus corresponding to the appropriate 4 cycle that you're wrapping. If you wrap it on the big one, then the gauge kinetic function, which means the gauge coupling, would be ridiculously small. It would be essentially 0, which is not phenomenologically okay. So you should be wrapping the D7 brains on one of the small 4 cycles. But it turned out to actually not change anything in terms of what the masses or the Gijinu, what the scalar masses or the Gijinu masses for those moduli are. There are also D3, D7 strings, which you can't really study explicitly in these models, because you can't get the Kalor potential for those by a dimensional reduction from some sort of DBI action. So the best thing you can do there is look at the explicit example. The only explicit examples where this Kalor potential is known, and those are orbital complications. And from those, it turns out that that these have masses, roughly speaking, like the V3 masses. And one also needs to worry about two extra contributions to the soft masses, which is the D-term contributions and the anomaly mediators. Now, the D-term contributions are very small in these sort of models because logical constant, what starts off with, is very, very small. So the D-term you need to lift to zero with logical constant is also tiny. And because the mass, well, the D-term contribution to the mass is just then proportional to the cosmological constant, you need it to cancel out, that's going to be very tiny. And anomaly mediated contributions are an interesting story because the Gravitino mass, we said, is larger than for example, the V3 brain masses by a certain factor of this volume. So the anomaly mediated contribution, because it's just a loop factor times the Gravitino mass, could start competing with the V3 modulus mediated mass. But if you take the volume to be sufficiently small, then this is not going to happen because the loop factor will be smaller than this power of V2 minus 1/6 of volume. But the really worrying place where anomaly mediation could be dominating is this one over volume squared for the Gugino masses on V3 brains. But it turns out even there, whereas naively, so if you have 1 over v squared from the moduli mediation, and you would expect from anomaly mediation to just have continuum mass, which is 1 over the volume times the loop factor, which would be much, much, much bigger than 1 over volume squared. But fortunately, there's this work of Bagley and Poppets where they systematically investigate anomaly mediation in string theory, at least in supergravity, at least for Gugino masses. They don't actually do it for any other soft breaking parameters. But they include not only the effect of the super wild anomaly, which is what was done originally in the paper by Randall and Sundermann, but they include all the other possible sources of anomaly, which is the scalar and signal anomalies also present in supergravity. And it turns out that you precisely get this 1 over v squared dependence, even from the one loop, so from the anomaly mediated contribution to the Gugino mass. Right, so now that you've computed all these soft masses, at least in large limits, so expressed as a certain powers of one over the volume, so you know the rough sizes and you know what they look like with respect to each other. Then you can formulate a few scenarios for trying to do phenomenology. And one of the scenarios is that you just put all the MSSM matter on V7s. And that's kind of the easiest case because we said that on V7s everything is already fixed, you know, already by fluxes. So essentially all the mass scales are basically the same, and that's expressed in this formula here. So the Gugino mass and the A terms and the scalar masses and the B term as well is fixed just through one mass scale, which is this M, which corresponds to 0-3 flux in theory. So of course we can, by tuning this flux, you can vary M. And by tuning certain other parameters, you can vary the string scale in a model. So essentially you can have a kind of range of possible string scale and a range of possible values of what this mass M can be. Now, the idea is that to do a phenomenological analysis of these models, you have to go through this renormalization group story, which is relevant because all these computations are done for the soft terms are done at the string scale, which is of course much, much higher than the energy scale relevant at the LHC, etc. So what we want to do is you want to apply renormalization group equations to evolve these parameters down, starting from the string scale to the weak scale, essentially, so to MZ, 4-7. And to do this,
do you do that from cosmological constant also?
I don't know. Well, no. Why would you do a renormalization group?
Well, it's you evaluating the cosmological constant and the string at the potential is evaluated just below the string scale. So you need to take into account all the corrections as you
But let me see. So, well, in this part of the story, this is completely decoupled from any sort of gravitational consideration. And now you literally just look at the standard model. You say, we have these soft parameters at the high scale. Let's evolve them down to the weak scale. And you forget the entire
issue. There's been a lot of shit.
Right. But you integrate out. I mean, the idea of soft terms is that you get those after integrating out gravity effects, basically. So that's how modular deviation works. You integrate out gravity, and you just left with an MSSM kind of global n equals 1 thing with these explicit soft gradient terms. So cosmology, cosmological constant and all these kind of things are not really there anymore.
Let's do that.
Well,
let's drop it.
Okay.
Isn't it easy that he's going to tune it away, so it's like something at the high scale, some enormous value, and then...
Yeah, of course, you have to tune it,
So then, once he's done that, he sends that once, and he doesn't have to send again, in the sense that the loops that you're talking about were part of the thing that he canceled with the tuning, but he didn't tell you where he tuned it, so he'll just adjust the tuning to...
Yeah, of course. You have to keep adjusting the tuning, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Right. But here we're just applying this normalization group flow to the soft parameters, and you can do this by using programs which already exist on the market. And one of them was written by our collaborator Ben Alnack. It's a fairly kind of simple process. Now, the problem here is that things are in a sense you're over constraining things because, by the fact that you're fixing the scale moduli, you predict the value for the string scale. Which is a bit of a problem because you know that in an MSSM, the gauge couplings unify at the gut scale. Now, you expect, from the string theory point of view, the gauge coupling, if things live on the same set of a grain, you expect the gauge couplings to unify at the string scale. So if the string scale is much lower than the gut scale, then you have to answer why is it that things are not unifying where the MSSM tells you that you unify them. And there's a nasty solution to this, which is adding extra matter to the game so that things can unify, so that gauge couplings can unify at a much lower scale than the gut scale, by which I mean 10 to the 16 GeV roughly speaking. Or alternatively, you can just say, well, there are certain models in string theory where you drop gauge unification completely, like if you have magnetized brains or Fernando suggested these brains at certain kind of singularities, which I don't really know much about. And there's also the question of stringy threshold corrections to the gauge kinetic functions, which can also kind of spoil or change where things are getting unified.
So what's forcing you to choose the string scale? Yeah. Just reading your slides says you're choosing it because you want to get
the string. Yeah, so the volume on the Fabia basically tells you what the string scale is. Just thinking about the relation between the Planck. I mean, Planck scale is fixed.
So why don't you choose that to be the 16 GeV and let things unify there?
Well, you can do that, but that means you're forcing your scalar masses to be exactly this, because everything is computed in terms of exactly one, essentially one parameter, which is this volume, and the amount of subsymmetry breaking, which is this W0 kind of thing. So there are not too many parameters to play with. I mean, it's really a constrained kind of model.
Why couldn't you make that a feature, saying that given it looks like things are going to unify, and that's telling you something about the masses
we're learning. So you could say that as well. You could say, okay, if you want things to unify 10 to 16, if you want string scale to be 10 to 16, then you have just this possibility. You have one possibility. But it turns out that possibility is not very nice in a sense. You have to fine-tune things again quite a lot. So for example, for these seven grains, the masses are very, very large. If you pick the string scale to be 10 to 16, then the masses of the modulus would be very large, and you have to fine tune W0 together to be small.
Why do you want to be small?
So you want it to be in the 1 TB range.
Which modulus are we talking about? Is it modulus?
No, the matter. The matter. You want to get the matter in the 1 TB range. Which
is an observed matter, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So you would have to play it again with some.
So the standard model is embedded in here somewhere. How's it embedded?
We don't specify that. We just say, okay, it's either sitting on D7s or D3s. The matter is somewhere there. And of course, we just use geometrical moduli, which is, of course, it's an oversimplification in some sense. So we don't know what happens if you start turning on fluxes on these D-rays, et cetera, because the Kalor potentials for these kind of things we don't know. So you can't compute the soft terms explicitly. I mean, you can make some analogies with the orbital models, et cetera, but, it's not.
So there's no option where if I unify things at 10 to 16 GB, some moduli are getting big, and then why can't I just choose the extent of my moduli where those moduli are moved somewhere else? Are all
you, you can, but I mean, you don't have that many options. You have B3s.
So since you didn't tell me the stat model, that's one of my options.
I didn't, but I told you. No, okay, so you have B3s and D7s, right?
Yeah.
And I told you what the subterms look like for both.
Right.
So, I mean, you can't put them anywhere else.
So is the statement that if I make the things unify at 10 to 16 GB, that every possible mass in the Lorentz theory, they're all too big?
Yeah, they'll be.
There's no sector at all of it.
No, you can do it on D7s. You can do it on D7s. And you can actually do it. That does work for D3 grains as well, if you fine tune W0. But then we can't really explicitly compute what the theory looks like. I'll come to that eventually.
But you said before, and Cliff was asking you many times before, that the mass is independent of W0.
Yes, okay, so for these D7 grains, what I'm doing here, okay, so there's a subtlety there, is that you forbid new terms. So the idea is that new terms would also be generated for these masses. But I can forbid those by, for example, putting the D7s at singularity or something like that. So you just have a discrete symmetry which forbids these new terms for appearing, which would come from these sort of fluxes which I was telling you about before. So I only allow the ones which Cliff was mentioning. So I only allow 0-3 flux to contribute to these D7 fields. Yes, yeah, so there's something there, you're right. Sorry. So for example, the natural If I want to start a model on D7 breaks, which is this first scenario which we have, then I must have, it turns out, if you just look at the table of the masses, then I must have a string scale of order 10 to the 9, which means very, very low string scale. And then you can do this RG analysis on that, which kind of seems, you know, it's a model with essentially no tuning. You don't need to tune W0 or anything like that. But it just doesn't work on the LHK very well, at least, because you get the stop to be the LSP, which means you have a charged LSP particle, which is.
But how do you know if you don't know what a standard model is? I mean, how do you do things as detailed you
could
tell us?
Well, no, so you just assume that all of the standard model is embedded into D7 breaks, is realized through geometric moduli with D7 breaks. Of course, I can't come up with an explicit construction which does this.
You have standard model, and these soft terms that you calculated, you say, well, that's the physics. And the dependence on the V's was coming from this, whatever the 7 grain lattice was.
Because the fluxes are the dominant source. Yeah, so that's it. I mean, you can't. The idea is to do everything, to do as much as possible without finding an explicit embedding. That's an unsolved problem in a sense. If you could find explicit embedding of the 7 model in some LBL application where you can also turn on fluxes and those kind of things, that would be amazing. But, I don't think, type 2D is not very good for that. Start off with. Right, so in this particular scenario, for example, you would get these, you would get the stop to be the LSP, which means you have a charged LSP, which is not so good, because you need arc right evaluation so that this thing decays in order to.
I don't want to labor it too much, but the thing that's making it difficult is the running part. It's always the things that are going wrong in the predictions are relying in an important way on the normalization group that took you from the barrier.
So there are two parts to the problem. There's the running part, and there's secondly, just as you pointed out, I mean, that everything is kind of related. Everything is expressed in terms of just U parameters, W0 and B. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, if you want the string scale to be the natural one, then the masses turn out to be large. So you have to play with that somehow. You have to tune W0 to reduce them while keeping the string scale constant. And then you have to go through the RG process to see even if that gives you something, something sensible. And some of the time it just doesn't. It's very hard to satisfy all the constraints. Especially if you take, for example, things like this this B term. So if you predict the B term for the Higgs parameter, if you take that very seriously, then things are really extremely, extremely, extremely constrained, because there are there's a set of formulae, which is kind of standard things from subsymmetry, sub-subsymmetry breaking, which relate the pair of values mu and v to this tan beta and the soft masses, and you need also to specify the sign of mu to be able to solve. So you see these two equations on the top. On the left hand side you have mu and v. On the right hand side you have tan beta, which is the ratio of the two Higgs webs in the MSSM. and the soft masses. So I can either specify the soft masses and time beta, or I can specify mu and v. Now, the problem is that we're predicting a value both for the soft masses and for v at the same time, which kind of, you know, so the equations are, everything is determined already, in a sense. And sometimes you can't satisfy all these constraints with the predictions for the soft terms. So for example, you had this computation that v is equal to minus 2m, which just comes out to supergravity. I mean, literally, you use the Keeler potential for this and geometric moduli, and you get this value for it. Of course, assuming that, you know, the Higgs fields are somehow embedded as geometric moduli of these V7 rates. And if you do that, it just turns out that it's very hard to actually satisfy this. So for example, here we had to drop this V equals minus 2. We just said, okay, well, we don't really know, you know, what solves the mu problem, essentially. What is it that fixes V and mu to be at the correct scale? So we just let them to be free, and then scaled over time beta. So we just said time beta is a free parameter, and sine mu is a free parameter, which effectively means that V is a free parameter. But, you know, if you took seriously the computation from supergravity, you wouldn't say it. And the idea was that we imposed certain homological constraints on these models. So we imposed this V equals less gamma branching ratio, which is kind of a small number, very sensitive to the extra non-standard model contributions. And same thing about the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon, which I think is currently still by almost 3 sigma out from the standard model value. So it's kind of really, really strict set of constraints. There's also the Higgs mass from the LEP data, which prefers a bigger value for tau beta. And there's the W-Mach constraint for the relic density of dark matter, which you can also apply. Now, that constraint is slightly, you know, fishy because there are a lot of assumptions about cosmology, etc., which go into these numbers. But if you apply that, then you get really, really extremely constrained set of parameters for the models that you can have. So what we do is you scan over these values, which are the free parameters. So essentially, you change this value m, which depends on the W0, which depends on the amount of supersymmetry breaking. You scan over all the possible m strings, so string scales, which look roughly chronologically okay, and you scan over possible time betas, which is a free parameter. And you also have the freedom of changing the sign of mu. And then you can do this renormalization group business, and you can get you can see what values of parameters you can satisfy all the constraints. So for example, on the top two graphs there, that's a scan in the m and tan beta plane for both mu greater than 0 and mu less than 0. And you can see that all these constraints just divide up the plane into allowed and disallowed regions. And for example, the tiny little green lines, only the strip between the two green lines is chronologically allowed. And that's the relic density constraint. So that one is in a sense the most strict. It really eliminates a lot of models, but, you know, it's also slightly, I mean, cosmology, you know. It's unclear whether all these assumptions are indeed true about cosmological models. So that's the idea. And, you know, you can you can find, dropping this assumption about V equals minus 2m, you can actually find a few models which satisfy all these four constraints, five constraints, which we impose. And you can compute the spectra for these models. So this, you can actually get numbers for what all the masses are. And, you know, I can tell you what the string scale is here, or what the volume requires. So you can trace it back to all the kind of string theory parameters, like what is the gauge group of these V7 rings which are undergoing the genomization, because all these parameters are essentially traced back to that. For example, the size of the volumes, etc., etc. So it's kind of nice, but again, not, you know, it's not easy to actually find the model which works. Okay, so besides these 7 grains, you could also try embedding everything into V3 grains. Now, the V3, V7 combination would be nice, but again, we don't know enough about the V3, V7 fields. We don't know what their KL potentials look like, etc. So it's
part of before you do that, are there any general properties of the results?
Of the spectra? There isn't anything really spectacular. I mean, the first two generations, more or less, degenerate.
So like one generic property is the fact that you had to give up this mu v thing means that if you really, if we lived in one of those vacua, something, the way you have to change the renormalization group is to have some unit degrees of freedom between the weak scale and the scale.
That's almost always there, essentially. Like, so if your strict scale is different from the gut scale, then you have to, and you want gauge unification at the strict scale, then you have to insert new matter.
Well, let's say we just put that aside. The zero third thing you did, just summarize what I think you said, is that the zero third thing didn't work because you got a too strong a prediction for mu and v, and so then you couldn't make anything better at all. So then you said, I'll drop the constraint on mu and v, which means that, as I understand it, means that
you don't have a constraint for mu, you have a constraint on soft masses and v, which gives you a result for mu. So mu is mu and v. You know, mu and tan beta, you can solve. If I give you n. So if I give you the soft masses and v, then you should be able to solve for mu and tan beta.
But I said it fine. If I just play back what I thought you said, is that it says that if you just plucked your soft terms into the normalization group and you got what you got,
yeah,
you didn't like what you got. So then you said, well, now I want to scan over beta and tan beta.
Yeah, exactly. Because, okay, so the point is that these equations you can't solve. You couldn't solve the equations with the prediction v equals minus 2m.
Right.
So the idea is that this prediction is true. Okay, those two formulae that I showed you are true at a scale, which is not the string scale. They're true at a much lower scale, at essentially the 1 TV, something like that, right? So I impose those formulae at the low scale. And then I evolve back up to the string scale, and I check whether I can have b equals minus 2m at that scale.
Right.
And I couldn't.
Right.
That's what was going on.
Right, but if you want to live here anyway, the statement that you're going to not allow yourself to do this parameter is pretty.
Yeah, exactly.
One way of making that work would be to say that there were other degrees of freedom between the string scale and the big scale, which were changing the normalization group basis. So your running was wrong.
Okay, yeah, true.
Right?
Yeah.
So it sounds like a generic statement would be that if you're living in these kind of vacua, you have to have something in there to change how things run.
Yeah. So
that could be a good, because then everything
you could. But then, of course, in string theory, you generally find exotic matter. That's another thing.
Right,
you
have to stretch. So,
for example, yeah, for intermediate scale scenarios are not that difficult to get. But, you know, it's not so nice. I mean, it's kind of spoiling the whole thing. I mean, if you believe that gauge unification means something, then at 10 to 16 GB, then, you know.
But to the extent that we're learning something generic, it sounds like the generic thing is it's hard to make it just work with just the MSSM in the second degree you put it in, assuming that the tendency breaks the least.
Right, so let me quickly skim through the other two scenarios. So the second one is where you're putting the matter in V3 grains, where we notice that the Kijino masses are much lighter than the scalar masses. So it looks like a split Suzy, unless the volume is very, very small, in which case it would be almost degenerate. By small, I don't mean small so that you know you can't trust the gravity, but just small-ish. So for generic values of the volume, I'm going to have a hierarchy between scalar masses and Kijino masses. So that looks like a split supersymmetry. And the problem is that actually what happens is that Kijino masses turn out to be too light in the kind of regime where you want them. So you have to think of how to lift these Kijino masses sufficiently, but big bodies. But that turns out to be okay, actually. You can do it because the A terms are very big, and the A terms contribute in the RGE evolution. So I start off at the string scale with very small Kijino masses, but at the low scale I can get them to be big enough because the A terms are reasonably big.
When you say that it looks like split supersymmetry, do you mean that the hierarchy problem is no longer being solved?
The spectrum looks like that, that's supersymmetry. So split supersymmetry. So the scalars are much heavier than the Kijino. But indeed, we did use, to analyze the problem, we used the RGE equations of specific solution, because the spectrum is what matters, determining the renormalization group equations. And here you just sort of get the generic features of the supersymmetry. So you get very heavy gluey inners and heavy Higgses and dark matter. You can satisfy all constraints in the relevant regions. So just to quickly skip through the last one. Well, in the last scenario, what you do is again you put everything on E3 rings, and you make the string scale essentially the God scale, so that there's no hierarchy anymore between the scalar masses and the Gugino masses. But the problem here is that you can't compute any, so it looks like M supergraph. But of course you can't compute any specific relations between these scalar masses and Gugino masses, because that would require knowing everything about the scalar potential for D3 breaks, and you don't, because that's to do with the actual geometry of the Fabian manifold. So we don't actually dare compute anything, because you know it just looks like M supergraph, and we can't say explicitly which subset of absolute parameter space it looks like, because that depends on all one of the coefficients which we don't have any control over. That's fast. Let's skip. Okay, so let me just conclude. So what do we do? We investigate this particular class of computations in type 2B string theory. And we did manage to get reasonably far with this renormalization group analysis. I mean, you can sort of just look at what you predict for these subterms. You can pick out the scenarios which would even vaguely, you know, seem to work, and you can do the RG analysis on them and see what you get at low energies, whether you can satisfy all these constraints, experimental constraints which we imposed, which are not even the kind of most strict one. I mean, eventually one would want to go to precision electroweak constraints and all these kind of things, but that would be amazingly difficult. And one of the most important conclusions is firstly that it is difficult to satisfy the constraints, so to find a model, even with very vague assumptions about things, which sort of works. And secondly, it's very, very important to have all the moduli fixed before starting to compute subsurface, precisely because of this reason that, for example, where the volume is fixed tells you what the string scale is. And where the string scale is very, very important, because you know, if you want to gauge unification, these kind of things, if it's lower, then you have to consider the extra matter. If you consider the extra matter, then it goes into all the other RGs as well. So you know, your RG analysis completely changes if the string scale is lowered by you know, a couple of orders of magnitude. And there's this comment about trying to, so of course the nice thing would be to find an explicit model in type 2B, which does this, but that's very difficult. So one could think about doing this sort of thing for the other existing models in string theory. So hadrotic, roughly speaking, looks like it could be nice, but because it has these explicit realization of the MSSM. But of course, those are without moduli fixing. So the papers of Holbert et al. Don't stabilize the moduli. And nobody really knows what's going to happen once you start stabilizing moduli, because you might actually spoil their results completely. Because as you know, in the heterotic string scenarios, once you turn on fluxes, which is what's going to be stabilizing moduli, the whole topology of the Calabi-Yau manifold you're working on can change. Right? But we don't know. Okay, I'll just
stop it. So there were a lot of questions for time, but if there's any pressing ones, if not, then I'll take care of the energy.